Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I'm sure most of you are probably a little tired of hearing about other people's reactions to President-elect Trump, but I just want to bring in one factor, which is, millions of people, or hundreds of millions of people, really, if you think about the whole global population, probably responded to this this completely unexpected, bizarre event as being surreal. And indeed, it did seem rather surreal. And what that made me think about is how when the sort of reality of it was hitting in, and I got this sense of like the surreal warp of reality opening up, something I couldn't predict, something that was strange, that was uncanny, that was almost dreamlike, it was a very strong reminder of how close the world of fantasy, of the imagination, is to our ordinary world. We tend to think of fantasy or the imagination in the fullest sense as being some little escape hatch that we plunge into now and again when we need a break from reality. But of course, as anybody who's paying attention to the world today knows, that reality itself can get pretty weird. And indeed, it's my firm belief that practices of the imagination, very much including reading, are one of the ways in which we can tap in, tune into, and to some degree fortify ourselves for the weirdness of the world, whether it's happening on the large scale of massive changes in media, society, a nation's self-image, to all of those little micro weirdnesses that inhabit our ordinary days, if we're paying attention. You know, the glimmer of a light on a tree, a random phrase from someone's conversation that resonates with something that you were thinking about, some odd flutter out of the corner of your eye. Indeed, our ordinary lives are suffused with enchantment, and one of the great gifts of spiritual practice and of deep imaginative work is our ability sometimes to tap into this intimate world of fantasy that is woven into our often, of course, very mundane lives. And then, of course, this becomes a theme in some fantasy literature, where it's the very tension between the quotidian realm and this realm of enchanted possibility for good or ill that really becomes the kind of thematic density. That's a lot of my favorite kind of fantasy literature. A literature, the imagination, is right on that borderline. I'm not as interested into, full, deep, completely surreal, bizarre worlds. I like worlds that are believable and realistic, but have warps and cracks and hidden passageways buried within them. So in that sense, I make very little distinction between great works of fantasy and great works, let's say, of the esoteric imagination, of Hermeticism, of Gnosticism, of alchemy. For me, they're very continuous ways of engaging the magic that is in matter, or that is part of our material existence on this plane. And all of this is a way of introducing our guest today. John Crowley is one of my favorite living writers, and probably my favorite living writer who works with works of the imagination. We can call them fantasy, although, the sort of spectacle of Game of Thrones, sword and sorcery, omnibus novels sort of tends to denigrate the phrase a little bit. So maybe we want to say something like high fantasy. John is best known for his book Little Big, which came out 25 years ago. And I know that because there's supposed to be a 25th anniversary edition, and it is yet to appear, and so the year is ticking down. So we'll see how rapidly that emerges. But Little Big is one of those transformative works that actually changes the way you feel in the world, at least while you're reading it, if not permanently. Pointing to again how close the enigmatic other is In that book, it's explored through fairy lore and then an increasingly Gnostic, apocalyptic kind of backstory in what is otherwise a recognizably real East Coast world. John also wrote the Egypt series, four marvelous books that are more realist and literary in that sense. I mean, they're all literary, but in the way in which we now think about contemporary literature, but they are also infused with this the remarkable possibilities of consciousness and of culture, indeed, particularly the Western esoteric tradition of Hermeticism, alchemy, Gnosticism, and ceremonial magic, but dealt with in a very subtle, very culturally rich fashion. And these are also life-changing books. For his latest project, John has worked on another life-changing book, but it's not his own life-changing book. It's a book that really had an enormous impact on the history of esotericism and hermeticism in the West. This is The Chemical Wedding, usually described as The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, though John has retitled it The Chemical Wedding by Christian Rosenkreutz because the hero of the book is not actually Christian Rosenkreutz so much. So we'll get into some of those mysteries. It's a book of many secrets, metafictions, and deep, deep enigmas. John has done a new translation of this book, really making the argument that it is this book really should be considered the first science fiction novel. So we'll find out what he means by that. With no further ado, John, thanks so much for joining me on Expanding Mind.
My pleasure.
So, you know, I'm kind of curious just in your own personal history, when it was in your life that you first discovered or stumbled across the Hermetic tradition, this Western sort of hidden stream of lore about alchemy and astrology and Gnostic secrets. In your work, it's so deeply digested. It just seems part of the way in which you see and imagine the world. So I can only imagine that this has been an interest and a part of your own imagination for a very long time.
Well, it has. That's true. First of all, I should point out that I grew up Catholic back in the time when the Catholic Church was itself a much more of a mystery religion than it is now. At least it was certainly couched in ritual and you used the term ceremonial magic, but of course we couldn't call it magic as we were growing up in it, but that is in effect the ceremonial religion, certainly it was. And they used a different language, too, Latin, which I learned to serve at Mass and participate in those mysteries myself. So that's one thing. More exactly, I came upon the stream of what you call astrology, magic, alchemy, esotericism and all that kind of stuff in the 1960s when it was almost impossible to avoid. It suddenly came to life again in those years and seemed to express possibilities that had been either not apparent to us in the world we lived in or had been somehow smothered up and become musty and old and the property of old-fashioned cultists and so on that ceased to interest people, thinking people very much. But suddenly there it was again, you know, and you had to know your astrological information, your sign, and your what those planets and where they were cast in your horoscope and what they portended for you in your life. I got into it too, and not in a particularly serious way. I'm not a believer. I don't believe in things. I am somehow immune. I was even when I was a Catholic. I, of course, became. I could not avoid belief in that sense, and yet at the same time, I never really, actually, in my own heart and mind, was convinced at all, and I when I was about 16, I could give it up without almost a pang, without a struggle at all. I turned out that I was immersed in it without believing in it. And it was a little bit like that in the 1960s.
A fascinating dimension. I mean, just to stay on this question of belief. I often wonder whether, because I have a very similar feeling about things, and it's been pretty constant throughout my life, and yet there's so many believing people and then radically disbelieving people around us. You know, so you, on the one hand, there are plenty of people who turn towards these practices out of a desire for a belief system, for a new way of organizing reality, for something that gives them a sense of discrete purpose or a kind of map that they can really assent to. And the fact that that's the case also means that on the other side of the fence, you have all these people who believe that if you're interested in these matters, or rather that the problem with them is that they're lies, they're fictions. And so you have people who are incredibly critical of things like astrology, because for them, the only important dimension is whether or not you're believing such a thing. And there's this middle way where engaging with these esoteric streams is a way of sort of training the imagination almost, or opening it up or populating it. But it really needs no justification outside of that kind of imaginative engagement.
I think that's right. And I'm not sure I would call it a middle way. I think that it's more expressed in my feelings in the title of Wallace Stevens' great poem, Toward a Supreme Fiction, that somehow that these notions and ideas and constructions of the mind are striving toward a supreme fiction, not a supreme reality, but a fiction that will contain all of the strivings of mind in ways that are expressive and unique and important and interesting. That's the way I kind of think of it.
No, when, that's beautiful. Go ahead.
When in the 1960s these things were around and capturing people's imaginations, what I enjoyed about them, what caused me to laugh and as well as become excited, was the possibilities that I'd never heard of. I mean, I'd never heard of the depths of complexity that these things had reached in former ages and were being rediscovered all around me. That was what was really interesting to me. I said that people would come up to me and say, "Do you know this?" I say, "No, I never heard of that." And it would be quite exciting. I was exploring, thinking about that kind of stuff in the 1960s even. And that was when the idea for the book that you described, Little Big, actually began, even though it wasn't finished until much later on. In fact, by the way, it was finished and published in 1981, which makes it 35 years old, not 25.
Oh, that's right.
That edition that you're talking about is way late. So I want everybody to understand that. It may, in fact, be still coming. Who knows? But I think we have to confess that it's way past its date. And it was right around, it was around then, late 1960s, that I went to the Brooklyn Public Library. I was living in New York on the Lower East Side, and the nearest big library you could actually take books out of was the Brooklyn Public Library across the river. And I went down there and was poking around. I can't remember now exactly what it was that I was looking for. And I came upon a book by Francis Yates called The Art of Memory. And that book was my introduction to the realms of esoteric thought that were held in the late Renaissance as they evolved then and opened up to me realms of intellectual striving, you might say, in the 16th, 15th, 16th, early 17th centuries that I had no idea of. The idea that there was an art of memory, that is to say, a way of organizing, using, deploying memory that like art, memory artists of the 17th century claimed to be able to do. I couldn't believe that anybody would be able to practice this art the way it was described in these books. It seemed like the outermost reach of human intellectual endeavor and complete bullshit, but at the same time, entrancing to think about the way these people that Francis Yates described were conceiving of and supposedly deploying memory. I couldn't believe it. And it was enormously inspiring.
So the idea there, of course, is that the imagination can be used in the kind of rich sense of developing right. images and landscapes and alternate architectures, and that one can use that part of the mind that we usually think of as being kind of irrational or just merely daydreaming or something, and you can use it very practically to be able to store memories and be able to recite a 2,000 line poem backwards or whatever, just by being able to walk through your imaginative palace in your mind. I mean, I remember reading when I discovered that stuff too when I was in college, and I was actually at Yale, and Harold Bloom was around, and we were reading Stevens and doing Gnosticism, and I was reading all these Gnostic texts and discovering this kind of esoteric lore. And growing up in the West or being interested in the history of Europe, it's amazing to discover this stuff because it's like there's a whole other Europe. There's like a whole other cast of characters, of conflicts and wars and insights and incredible art. And once you tune into it, it's this rich game, if you will, or it's more than a game, but it's a way of understanding our own history. But there's like a kind of secret in it, and whether it's a true secret or it's just a game of secrets, it almost doesn't matter, but there's something behind the surfaces. So you start looking at the Greek gods in Renaissance art suddenly take on a little bit more charisma.
Yes, absolutely. They do. And that's what that's what intrigued me, was this sudden alteration in the intellectual history of the 17th and earlier centuries that was entirely new to me. It was known to scholars. It was known to Francis Yates, who had studied it for years, but it was entirely new to me. It was one of those moments that happens to you. You say, oh, the history of mind is not only a real thing, but far deeper, longer, and larger than I ever knew it to be. And the idea that you could deploy memory in this way, or at least that they thought they could. I mean, there are some of the things that they thought they could do in this art of memory that I was exploring were ridiculous. First of all, not only to me impossible, but useless. I mean, they thought, well, not only can you remember things, as you say, by using the places and sites of a building that you would memorize and then put your various things you needed to remember on it, which is a purely practical system, which is still used by memory artists, by the way. I learned later on, people who have these gigantic memories who can rename you or remember long lists of things that you give them in perfect order, not only just after you've given it to them, but much later on, use the same system. They might not use it exactly in the same way. They don't memorize church interiors the way the memory artists of the 16th century or 17th century did, but they can do the same thing. But that wasn't the end of it. I mean, that was just the beginning, that memory artists would start to use the places of astrology, all the houses of the zodiac, all the places of classical art and the realms of the gods and so on, which got them in a lot of trouble with the Catholic Church, which just said, all right, now you are treading on the realms of magic, which are forbidden and are dangerous to use. You're going to end up drifting away from God, who is the only real power in the universe, and his creation of our souls is as far as you want to go with any of this. They're saying, no, we're discovering powers that have been forbidden for a long time, but are real powers. Well, that was very exciting to the 17th century, and it was somewhat the same kind of thing that was happening in the 1960s to thinking people all over the place. They were discovering not only an intellectual and arcane and occult tradition from the 17th century, 16th century, the Middle Ages, but they were rediscovering all the people, the secret thread somehow, so to speak, of all the other people who had believed in it and worked on it and developed it and pondered it from the 17th and early centuries to the present. And I didn't even know about them either. I mean, people like, you know, that preserved all of this stuff and Francis Yates and earlier than her, people like A.E. Waite and the people who published all these outlandish esoteric volumes like The Chemical Wedding. I had come upon, you know, just I felt like Yates, that is to say William Butler, not Francis, when the spirits whose automatic writing were revealed by his wife's automatic writing, when Yates said, this is wonderful stuff, I'm learning the nature of the universe, would you like me to give up everything and just publicize all of this stuff and put it out on the world? And the spirits writing through his wife said, no, we don't want you to do that. We have come to give you metaphors for poetry. And Yates would go on for the rest of his life and using it in that way. And that's what I felt like I had been given.
A question. When in the 60s, when you were discovering this stuff and getting into it, you were also beginning your career as a novelist, and you were starting to work on stories in your early books like Beasts in the Deep. Mm-hmm. For you, were those parallel processes? Was it kind of one work or engagement with the imagination, or did it take you a little while to start to see the connections between your own writing or the kind of genres of fantasy and science fiction that you were playing off of and this interest in esotericism?
My interest in esotericism was I suppose was self-justifying in a way at the beginning. And it was not a time when I was beginning to think about trying to write novels. I had always written from the time I was a little kid, but in the 1960s, what I wanted to do was make movies, not write novels. So this kind of became a little bit latent. It was fascinating to me and compelling to me, but I didn't have any immediate use for it, so to speak. But by the end of that decade and coming into the 1970s, I did start thinking about large projects. I kind of inchoate. I didn't know what I intended to do with the thinking that I was doing, but it did become an engine that I knew would drive some parts of what I was doing. If you read Little Big, you know that even in that book, even though it came out 20 years later, I had already been thinking of in the middle of the 1960s, late in the 1960s at least. And it does feature a lot of references to arcane systems of knowledge, especially the imagery that's deployed on a set of tarot-like cards that are in that book. Those derive directly from imagery that's in Francis Yates and was deployed by memory artists back then, especially Giordano Bruno, who invented dozens of systems of remembering things that were somehow more than systems for remembering things. And so, yes, it was feeding into the way I was thinking about fiction even then, even when I didn't know I was thinking about fiction. And when it finally did emerge as something that I could use in itself, and not just as an inspiration, I was ready to take it on. That it doesn't appear in the first two or three books that I wrote, which were these rather short science fiction novels. It doesn't necessarily appear in those. There is also in The Deep, the first novel I published, there is also a set of symbolic cards whose imagery is also taken from the memory systems. But I wasn't ready yet to fully deploy it. It wasn't really until I started thinking about the Egypt books that I saw a way to use all of that stuff. But the funny thing about me as a writer is that it's almost as though it's hard to explain exactly, is that my entire my entire writing life seems to me as though it always existed, and or at least from very early on, and I just had to just pick up the parts of it that were there waiting to be picked up and turn them into novels.
Do you mean what was always there? The books were already written?
The books were already there.
The ideas were already there?
Yes, all of it was already there. The motives for writing those books rather than other books. The books themselves, not in their specifics, which all had to be supplied, but in their ethos, their motivations, nature, their I don't know what you would call it. What is that in books that lies beneath the events and the characters and the language and all that? That all seemed to, when I would start on a book, to have already all been there. I just had to select the next one off the list.
Well, what that points out to me is also how enchanting and also tricky it can be to just talk about the magic of books, just that in the process of reading and writing, whether you're reading history, whether you're reading fantastic literature, whether you're reading esoteric texts, and then writing about them, through them, within that stream, that process itself kind of takes on, to some degree, some of the logics of enchantment that are in the books themselves, so that there's some weird way that writing becomes kind of part of the stream. So when I think about the esoteric tradition in the West as a kind of, if I think about it in spiritual terms, what does it mean to be part of this stream in some sense on a kind of very personal way, beyond an intellectual approach? A lot of it is that it's just a certain way of inhabiting the stream of writing and reading. That allows it its own kind of inherent metafictional magic to spill out of the acts themselves and to kind of take on this extra character. And I've always gotten that feeling very much from at least some of your books, you know, particularly Little Big and the Egypt Cycle, that's part of what makes them very special to me. And it sounds like you have your own experience of that kind of that sort of esoteric textuality or that's going on through this stuff.
Oh, I think that's true. I think that if you look back at the writings that have influenced you the most or that have inspired you with the greatest and deepest feelings, they seem to be form. I mean, Harold Bloom knows all about this. They seem to form for you a personal religion, a personal body of spiritual knowledge, even though you would be a little bit shy to say that, it does. And when you're searching for understandings of yourself and the ups and downs in the world, the darknesses and the lights of the world, that's what comes to you. You wouldn't say, I follow this as a religion. That is to say, the only actual sacrament involved is reading, but it forms a kind of body, personal mythos that you can't really do without. I mean, which sustains you.
So you've one of the books clearly that is in your personal religion is this book that has recently been translated, The Chemical Wedding, by or of Christian Rosenkreutz. When did you first encounter that book? And give us some, you know, some background on the time and place in the 17th century when this most mysterious text emerged.
I first came upon it again in Frances Yates. I was reading her works, which are explanations or explorations of the intellectual world of the early late 16th and early 17th centuries, including the work of the writings and life of Giordano Bruno, and other texts that seemed to her relevant to that, and one of them was the chemical wedding, which she places in the tradition of religious and magical influences on the politics, especially, of that period. And she took the chemical wedding, which is a story about a guy who goes to a magic castle and observes wonders there, and joins or is inducted into a brotherhood there that is supposed to go out into the world and do good, and relates it. Yeats then relates it to the political doings in Germany in where. Approximately where it was written, in the period in which it was written, in which the Elector Palatine of the Rhine, one of the people who was able to vote for, call him an elector because he was one of the people who could vote for the Holy Roman Emperor, and whose castle, home castle, was the castle still existent today in Heidelberg, and he went and married the daughter of James the First. And that wedding and the attendant celebration of it and the carts and wagons and shows and plays that surrounded the wedding in Heidelberg at this castle, and the magic, or supposedly naturally magical, things like automatons and speaking statues and so on that were exhibited there, seemed to Yeats to be obviously related, and that she undertook to believe, or to write, to make the claim that the chemical wedding was, in fact, importantly, about that marriage and that castle and that hope that was placed in the Elector Palatine, who was a Protestant, to advanced Protestant causes throughout Germany, and failed terribly when the 30 Years' War began in 1618. And he actually died in the course of it. So this is pretty thrilling. And she, her précis of the chemical wedding in there was pretty amazing to me too. And so finally, at some length after that, I actually read the whole thing. I mean, she had just written a précis of it. And I found it to be even stranger than she described it to be. And to me, really couldn't quite be fitted into the sort of political allegory that she conceived it to be. I thought it was even something even weirder than that. And began to try to figure out what the heck it was.
Yeah, I mean that's what's one of the things that's so wonderful about it, and I think is really brought forward in your translation, is that when you have a text like this at this time in history, the impulse for commentators, for readers of this thing, is allegory. That all the weird symbols that you encounter, all the strange events that have this kind of dreamlike, surrealist, but sort of organized character. They must mean some specific thing. So for Yeats, it's a political allegory. And then, of course, for a lot of people who have read the text, it's a allegory about alchemy and spiritual progress and the nature of spiritual reality. And so there clearly is an allegorical dimension to it, but it's not just allegorical. And that's the part where that you really have brought forward in your approach to the text, and I think in your translation to the text as well. So I would love to hear you talk a little bit about that tension between allegory as a mode of writing and something more like literature or the novel or fantasy novel. There's a tension there that's really interesting that this text seems to specifically almost be about.
Yes. Right, I think that's true. Here's the thing. Allegories in themselves are actually sort of the most boring kind of literature you can write, in my opinion. I mean, the idea of constructing a fake story in which everything in it stands for something that's in a supposedly true story to me has limited interest. You have to be a genius like Spencer in The Faerie Queen to sort of bring that off. Or you got to have a grip of your audience so that you know that the story you're telling will be apparent and obvious to them. And even though amusing in itself and interesting in itself, vivid in itself, will tell truths that that exist on a higher plane and that your readers are certainly going to get, which is the case with other kinds of simple religious allegories, which are enormously popular at the time. So I think, however, that what happens to old allegories, which may have had a secret political meaning, a secret religious meaning, a secret alchemical meaning, because alchemy was enormously committed to keeping all of its secrets, of its processes and so on, close to its chest. If the import, which was there at the beginning, gets forgotten, we can't retrieve it anymore, or we can't retrieve it without enormous exercise of research. When we read a text like that, it exists for itself and has become, sort of by kind of internal alchemy of forgetting, becomes a much more interesting thing just because we can't understand it, because it won't yield up its topics like that. So that to me is, in a way, when I read The Chemical Wedding for myself, in the light of my own knowledge of alchemy as it stood then and my knowledge of the political situation and in the period, I could relate it to that. But supposing that it were a point-by-point allegory, and this is, I suppose, conceivable that it was, because the author was interested in and knew an awful lot about alchemy. Obviously, from his biography, we can guess this, and from the things that he says in the text, a lot of that had vanished. And what you have instead is a text where a lot of really mysterious and astonishing things happen, and the interpretation of it is up to you. I mean, it will not channel you toward a single meaning. You have to do it for yourself. So that was what really interested me.
When the book came out, what was it, you know, how did it play into the sort of emerging Rosicrucian mythos? I know there are these earlier Rosicrucian texts that appear a number of years earlier that sort of implied that there was this already existing secret society of kind of Christian esoteric world changers. But most people think that this wasn't actually, that these texts weren't referring to an actual existing society, but were kind of like games or metafictions, or maybe they were even attempts to spark the very thing that they were referring to, which they did, because people then started to actually say, oh, to look for Rosicrucians and to start doing Rosicrucian things themselves to some degree. How did The Chemical Wedding come into that story as a was it a very popular at the time? Did it seem to be evidence of some new truth that people had to deal with?
I think that it fitted into it very very well, and it is the most elaborated one as far as a story goes. The previous two most widely read or widely noticed tracts were tracts. One was declaring the existence of this brotherhood and talking about its history, which went back 200 years, and when their founder, Brother R.C., which is the only way he was named in the original text, lived 150 years or something and went all through the East and Egypt and Arabia collecting information and learning all about magic and medicine, and then died, and had passed on his wisdom and knowledge to a brotherhood, which is now going around the world, and its time has come, and it's going to change everything. It has enormous power. Its members are only out there to do good, and they will change society. They may have to overthrow kings and maybe even the Pope, and institute a new society and bring about, or at least align themselves with, a huge change in all of social relations. new heaven and new earth. And these were pretty thrilling. And as you can imagine, at the time when they appear, the Christian world, Christendom, in effect, the Western world, is has been long shaken by, these divisions in religion, which have occasioned all kinds of wars, especially in France. A new war is expected any time, and people are thinking, how are we going to avoid a new apocalyptic war of religion? Well, the Rosicrucians say, listen to us. We will solve all the problems in religion, because we have the true religion. We have the true answer to all these questions. And so they were very exciting in that way. But they were just, it was a tract. It was not a story. And then a further one comes out, which tells even in more detail what this Rosicrucians are doing, that they'll pass among you invisibly and so on, and do work for you and be on your side and solve your problems. And then, after these two tracts appear, there comes this little novel, which is an entirely different kind of kettle of fish, and doesn't do any of that stuff. It does contain the idea of a brotherhood, which is going to go out in the world and do good, but it appears only really at the very end of the story, when the people who have gone through this these alchemical rituals within this magic castle form up at the end, and then are they all supposed to become brothers, not Rosicrucian brothers, not brothers of the Rose Cross, but brothers of the Golden Stone. And they are supposed to head out into the world and do good, and they do leave at the end. That's the end of the story, is their departure for the world in which they're going to go out and do good. So it does follow on, but once you sit down and read the thing, it's completely different than what you expect. There is a brother R.C. in it, Christian Rosenkreutz, Rosenkreutz means Rosy Cross, and that's his emblem, and his heraldic sign is a cross, white cross on a red field red cross on a white field with four roses in the four spaces. And so he's a Rosy Cross guy in some sense, but he's not at all the kind of person that Brother R.C. was reported to be in these alchemical texts. He doesn't do anything. He just goes to this, he's a kind of confused, good-hearted old guy who goes to this castle because he gets an invitation to go to a wedding. And events that happen in the castle are mysterious to him and hard to explicate, though he says, I'll tell you more later if I can. And he goes through all this bizarre sets of events which we can hardly understand. They certainly have something to do with alchemy. And it seems like they could be some sort of allegory of alchemical practice, but they're very difficult to interpret if that's the case. And at the end, rather than going off with the rest of the brothers that are going to go off and do good in the world, he's left alone because he failed at the task that he was supposed to do, and has been spurned and cast out of the order to which he belongs. And so it's just nothing like what you would expect a book supposedly about the remaking of the world through magic and science and so on, the way that it's been proposed.
So this is what has led you to think about the book as you call it, the first science fiction novel. I mean, usually people look at Johannes Kepler, who wrote a kind of moon trip of fantasy in the early 17th century, Somnium, and that people will talk about that as the sort of first science fiction novel. But you're putting forward the Chemical Wedding. Is it because it has just too many elements that don't make sense as an allegory of anything, that there's too many just imaginative details about characters' reactions, about the overall arc of the story, that there's some that like fiction as its own singular force is being allowed into this allegorical space to make something else happen, something more like a novel than like a encoded recipe of how to do alchemy or something like that.
Right. It's not only I can't read it. I cannot accept it as an alchemical recipe just because I can't even conceive how it can be followed. Many alchemical texts hide their secrets, but you can make some guesses, and people really skilled in alchemical texts can usually come up with some way of understanding what might have been done and what the hopes of the alchemists were, but not the chemical wedding. You can't figure out anything from it. And yes, you're right. I think of it as a novel because it's about people. It's about this guy and about the other people that he meets in the course of his visit to this castle. He's a real person. It's written in the first person. He tells us his own story and of all the adventures that he has. And we get a real sense of him as a very ordinary, kind of humble, sometimes touchy, sometimes horny, sometimes puzzled guy that's very novelistic. And the idea of it being science fiction, to me, is that, first of all, you would have to, in order for something to be called a science fiction, would have to have some definition of fiction and some definition of science to create it. Well, I think the fictional part is clear. It really is a novel. Even Francis Yates calls it a novel. And would have to have some sense of science, too. And I think that the science in The Chemical Wedding is alchemy, basically, but other things as well, and like automatons and transformations of various kinds, and several other instances of the kinds of magic that was practiced in the 17th century. But what those were in 17th century terms were, or can be understood as, science. Alchemy was a science. It was designed to create by physical processes new materials and wonders and progress for mankind. So in those terms, it was a science, even though by our standards you wouldn't call it a science because most of the scientific processes weren't organized in the way that actual scientific processes are. And, of course, it was all kept secret, which scientific results can't be in order to make any kind of progress in science. But it functions in this story exactly the way that true science, or what we call modern science, functions in early science fiction. Early science fiction novels, if you read them, the science in them is bullshit. It's like the writers would take anything they wanted out of the sort of panoply of ongoing science. Electricity, relativity, faster-than-light speeds, chemicals that could produce various kinds of results, galaxies and planets that could be visited and what they would be like. None of it is really scientific, exactly. I mean, it relies on the existence of scientific thinking about these things in the same way as the events in Chemical Wedding rely on the body of alchemy that most people who read anything would have been sort of familiar with. But the science and science, early science fiction, is mostly not actual science. There's a few what they call hard science stuff from the early history of science fiction and ongoing too, where it's a story that's designed to explicate a set of scientific premises or proposals or theories. And that's a small part of what science fiction is. Science fiction mostly is fiction. It's mostly adventure fiction. It's mostly astonishing tales, amazing stories, which is the title of one of the great science fiction magazines that's lasted down to the present. And amazement and astonishment and fantastic events and fantastic possibilities are what science fiction was always filled with.
Well, one of the things I like about the argument... Go ahead.
I was going to say it has the extra, like it's the same kind of thing as all kinds of romances, mystery stories, gothic tales, boys' adventure, all those kinds of things, except it has this extra, which says, these things, our wonders and our books, are based on these scientific possibilities. And that's what Chemical Wedding is. It says, this is a romance. It's a story about crazy adventures in a castle, but it has the extra stuff that is based on the real possibilities, which you, the reader, know are inherent in our processes of alchemy and magic and other kinds of esoteric science, you might call it.
Yeah, I mean, again, it seems to suggest that part of the appeal of this kind of literature, whether we think of it as, you know, fantastic novels or as esoteric explorations, is precisely that conjunction of the world of fantastic possibility with, like, actual possibility. That it's the tension between them, again, that sort of one foot in the world of matter and one foot in this world of possibility, that really is the kind of origin of the strength of a lot of these texts and their kind of abiding interest. And by insisting that we can go back to the early 17th century and look at a work of alchemical fantasy as a science fiction, I think it's a really positive gesture towards acknowledging that this has always been a part of science. That if, you know, if we look at the 17th century as the great hinge point where we start to enter into a scientific disenchanted world with Descartes and Boyle and all that stuff, that it's, I think, really important to recognize that the fantastical imagination is woven into that process from the get-go. It's right. It's coterminous with it. It's not just something that people do on the edges of it. It's actually kind of part of the very stream of it.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I think that eventually what science has to do in the later 17th century, starting with Bacon, but going through Descartes and all those, is to dissociate itself from what was called science before, which just means general wisdom, but was the things that were practiced by alchemists and astrologers and people like that, and say, we aren't doing that. We are doing something else than that. And we are divorcing science from things like spirituality and religion and supernatural beings and so on, all these things which sort of infested or at least lived in the thinking of alchemy and astrology and magic and so on, natural magic, which was another word for sort of magical practices or technological practices in the 17th century. So yes, you're right, but a divide was going to happen, and this history was going to get buried. And one of Frances Yates's great contributions, and she's not the only one, but she's the one I read, was to return to that period and recover these roots of science in this realm of speculation, of spiritual striving, of personal illumination and all that kind of stuff that had already been discarded by science and therefore thought was done with, except of course that there were always people who continued to be interested in it and retain it and divorced it farther and farther and farther from what was actually going on in science, so that you get finally to a character like Jung, Carl Jung, who could take the work of alchemy and talk about it exclusively as stories of psychological and spiritual development, and that has nothing to do with actual physical processes at all, which I always thought was really weird.
It's funny how conversations around alchemy have gone back and forth, and now, you know, the cutting edge scholars about alchemy have come back to really reemphasizing the physical proto-scientific practices, and there's been a real resistance to Jung, although of course his ideas continue to influence, you know, people who are interested in psychology and archetypal images and spirituality and things like this. We only have a couple of minutes left, and I just wanted to ask you a question about your own work. I mean, particularly not so much this translation, because that's obviously part of the of the current, of the kind of esoteric literature. But when you think about Little Big, when you think about the Egypt books and some of the other novels, but really those especially, do you see them as being in some ways part of this esoteric current or merely fictions inspired by?
I would call them fictions inspired by rather than a part of it. I think there's one thing that's always interested me is that people who really believe in this stuff or think of it as being a genuine or actual path to spiritual enlightenment and truths beyond the ordinary tend to have not much interest in my books. In general. I mean, they don't appear in the occult bookstores. They don't, you know, it's obvious when you read them from the point of view of somebody who is basically looking for esoteric and hidden truths that my books don't contain those. They might contain truth in another sense, but they don't contain this is not Morning of the Magicians. This is not, you know, one of those kinds of books that Chariots of the Gods. It's not something where you're going to find out truths about the world. They are fictions. They have their own logic and their own ontology.
Yeah, that makes sense. For me, I've always read them. I tend to read them as part of it, but only because I read the tradition itself in an ironic way.
Yes. There's no other way to read it.
Again, because I'm not a believer. You know, I can't. I just. There's some extra juice in them. But we're going to have to end it here. We can keep going. You know, I've been wanting to have you on the show for a long time, and it's wonderful to have a conversation with you. And I encourage people to go out and read the new translation as well as your old books. Do you have anything else coming out soon?
No, not soon. This is the one for now. There is going to be a new novel, which announcement of which is not too far off. But I have been vowed to silence by my
that's
publisher.
That's good. Like an alchemist, you're going to keep the cards close to your chest.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
All right, John. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling.
Till next week, keep your minds open.